Good evening.
Good evening.
The sound, oh, that's loud. It's good? Okay. Well, thank you for coming back. Most of you came back. It's really gratifying. I was, Karen, my wife, and I are watching the HBO series, which I highly recommend, called Angels in America. Well, I think it was done some time ago, but it's based on Tony Kushner's play that was done in the early 90s, and they made an HBO movie of it. So we were watching episode the other night, and one of the characters was going into some rant about the meaning of life, and his partner cut him off and said, "Very Zen, totally incomprehensible, and completely useless." So naturally, I thought of our class. And whereas I'm prepared for the information here to be completely useless, and that's of course, you know, an appropriate thing. Over there at the Karen and I were also at an ordination at the Berkeley Zen Center last Saturday, and they have a 50-year anniversary T-shirt that says "Accomplishing Nothing for 50 Years." So that's appropriate. That's fine. And but my goal actually is to make this useless teaching comprehensible. So and since you all came back, I'm thinking I might be achieving some. I have some delusion that I have some success here. Maybe you need to come back because what was that all about, right? In any case, I will review a little bit of what I said last week, just to kind of reinforce the teachings from last week, and then go on to some new material. So as I said, Yogacara is one of two schools of Buddhism that arise in the early part of the Common Era, and they are the progenitors of the Mahayana, the greater vehicle. The Yogacara arose in India, and it was carried to China and Tibet by a group or, you know, various translator monks who made the journeys between those, at that time, very distant places. And list of our Zen ancestors is one of the we call the people on the Zen ancestor list Daisho, which means great teacher. And one of the greatest of those great teachers is Vasubandhu. And Vasubandhu is the name most associated with the Yogacara school. And at one point, when I was preparing to deliver this class, I thought we might introduce his most famous Yogacara teaching, which is the 30 verses. That seems unlikely to me now that things have progressed this far. I don't think we will get to that in this class. But I'm hoping that we might study that text. And there's a very readable translation with commentary of that text that we recommended on the website. It's by Ben Connolly, a contemporary American Zen teacher. So I think maybe in the fall when we do a study period, we typically do in the fall, we might get to that book. But this class will be an excellent basis for understanding and not turning away from that book when you get it. And I think the name of the book is something Yogacara's, you got it there, Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara. So there's your summer reading book. But the Yogacara school literally means yoga practice. It's synonymous with the teachings of mind only, citta matra in Sanskrit, or representation only, which has a more difficult name, vijñapti matrata. So mind only or representation only are synonyms for the Yogacara or the yoga practice school. And this is how the Buddhist scholar John Powell, scholar and translator, summarizes the teaching of representation only or mind only. He says, all perceptions are mediated and interpreted by the mind. No aspect of the outside world appears directly to awareness. Sense impressions of phenomena relay information to the mind and are then interpreted. And the cognitions of any individual reflect the physical realities of his species and perceptual faculties, background, language, and life experience. There is no direct experience outside of meditation. And all cognitions, all thinking, has an interpretive overlay. So last week I mentioned a much simpler set of words that capture somewhat more poetically even this sense of representation only or mind only. And those are the words from the Dhammapada that I read last time. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, and made by mind. This is the opening stanzas of one of the earliest teachings we have from the Buddha. The opening stanzas that show this interest and this focus on how mind is interpreting experience. So last week I said that Yogacara is interested in, big word coming, epistemology. And epistemology is the study of how we know what we know. And I reminded us that all Buddhist schools have a common epistemological foundation. They all look at the five senses as the source of what we know, the five physical senses plus mind. And mind is, for Buddhism, the sixth sense. So, and each sense has a field. So we get eye and sight, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste, up to mind and mind objects, which are mind objects are thoughts, or also sometimes phenomena or dharmas are the objects of mind. So the objects of mind are a little different because they aren't necessarily material. The objects of the physical senses are all material things. Sound is a material thing. It's you can't see it, but it's, we know from physics that it's a wave. All the other senses are based on material impressions, whereas mind can contemplate the immaterial. It can contemplate all. It can think about anything that exists. It can also imagine. And I mentioned that the six senses, including mind, plus the six sense field, plus the six sense consciousnesses. There's a consciousness associated with each sense, each pair of senses and fields. Combination of those make 18, and those are called the dhatus, or the elements. So Yogacara teaches that what we know is only consciousness itself. It emphasizes this mediated nature of our experience. We only know what appears in consciousness, and what appears there is an indirect experience based on sense perception. Another way of saying this is we only know our perceptions. We only know the real, we don't know the real nature of things. But the Yogacarans were philosophers. They wanted to know the real nature of things. They then created meditations that were based in looking at consciousness itself, turning back the light to look at consciousness itself. And consciousness is the source of all our conceptualizations about the world. So, I want to read something from one of our first teachers, Suzuki Roshi, and he is here speaking with his Yogacara hat on, and I think you'll hear very much this kind of perspective in these words from this book called Branching Streams, Flow in the Darkness. He says, in Japan we say hibiki. Hibiki means something that goes back and forth like an echo. If I say something, I will get feedback back and forth. That is sound. Buddhists understand sound as something created in our mind. Buddhists understand sound as something created in our mind. So our naive impression, right, is that sound comes from outside. You're over there, you hear my voice. Sound is coming from me. He goes on, I may think the bird is singing over there, but when I hear the bird is me already. Actually, I'm not listening to the bird. The bird is here in my mind already, and I am singing with the bird. Peep, peep, peep. If you think while you are studying, the blue jay is singing above my roof, but its voice is not so good, that thought is noise. When you are not disturbed by blue jays will come right into your heart, and you will be a blue jay. And the blue jay will be reading something, and then the blue jay will not disturb your reading. When we think the blue jay over my roof should not be there, that thought is a more primitive understanding of being. Because of our lack of practice, we understand things in that way. The more you practice Zazen, the more you will be able to accept something as your own, whatever it is. So this is just not, a theory. It's really important to emphasize that. This is just not another conceptualization. This is a report. This is a report from the mind of a person who has gone deeply into meditation and has had an encounter or many encounters with something called direct perception. And there was a definition of direct perception in one of the pages that I handed out last week that you can read. So this is Suzuki Roshi reporting from a mind that has penetrated the barrier between subject and object, and he's reporting what how that feels, what that experience is. And the experience is no separation. No separation. And to have such an experience is it can't be expressed, really. It can't be expressed. So, last time, I I brought up the scriptural source for the Yogacara, which is called the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra. What's that?
Samdhi Nirmochana.
Oh, thank you. Would you say that louder?
Samdhi Nirmochana.
That's how you say it, with a nice accent from Manhattan. Samdhi Nirmochana, anyway, in with the unaccented, that's how I say it. But it appeared in the third century of the Common Era. But it appears as a sutra, as the words of the Buddha, and it's based on this sutra that the Yogacarans begin to develop their understanding that there are three. What Vasubandhu calls three transformations of mind consciousness. So this is how Vasubandhu characterized them. I wrote down three kinds. I don't know if kinds is right. You know, the actual word that Vasubandhu, whose words we must respect, at least as translated, are three transformations of consciousness. So you might get the impression from that, I kind of get the impression that there is a unity to consciousness, but that it can transform in three different ways. It can appear in three different ways. So I haven't run this by my teacher, but there is the word for consciousness, which is citta, which is has a sense of just mind in general, or mind without any transformations. So I'm going to ask my teacher about this, but my sense is that citta we might think of as, like when we say bodhicitta, the thought of enlightenment, the mind of enlightenment, we might think of citta that way, and then we might think of these other ones that I'm going to talk about, the alaya vijnana, manas, and manovijnana, as possibilities of transformation of consciousness, ways that we can relate to consciousness, or consciousness relates to us, or the ways that consciousness can appear. So, as I say, there are three, and in addition to in the original teachings, we always have as the sixth consciousness. You got mind and its objects, and then you have a consciousness that goes with that pair. The sixth consciousness That's in common to all Buddhist schools. There's nothing new in that. Yogacara didn't invent that. Yogacara does attribute, it does describe mind consciousness and perhaps in a little bit different way than had been previously described. But mind consciousness is just an ordinary part of the 18 dhatus common to all Buddhist schools. The two innovations of the Yogacara, where they innovate based on the Samdhi-nirmocana and say there are two in addition to the original six consciousnesses, and those two are manas and alaya vijnana. So I'm going to go into those. But I was wondering if somebody could read do you have the handout from last week?
Yeah.
Do you have the quote at the top of the page about that references a fellow named Visala Mati? Mm-hmm. Would you be willing, is there a microphone there somewhere where Kenny could read that?
Then the Bodhisattva Visalamati questioned the Buddha. Bhagavan, when you say Bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness, Bhagavan, just how are Bodhisattvas wise with respect to the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness? For what reason does the Tathagata designate a bodhisattva as wise with respect to the secrets of mind, alaya vijnana, thought, manas or klista manas, and consciousness, mano vijnana, from the Samdhi-nirmocana Sutra, Chapter 5.
Excellent. Well, I put in parentheses the Sanskrit names of those of mind, thought, and consciousness. How is a bodhisattva wise with respect to mind, thought, and consciousness? I put those in. By reading the translator's notes to the sutra, I was able to determine that that's where the first reference is to these three transformations of consciousness. So these three transformations of consciousness. And so in a handout, I put a definition of each of those consciousnesses from the Princeton Dictionary on Buddhism. So scholarly definition of those. And then I followed that with a quote from Reb Anderson's book on the Samdhi-nirmocana Sutra called The Third Turning of the Wheel. So you can read those on your own. We don't need to go over those now. The main topic, the main topic of you know, since everybody, when the Samdhi-nirmocana Sutra appears, everybody knows about mano vijnana. They don't need to have a lot of disquisition on that. So there isn't much disquisition on that in the sutra. What the main subject is alaya vijnana, this new idea of the storehouse consciousness. But first I will talk about mano vijnana, the mind consciousness that is common to all the Buddhist schools, just so we have that background. And so the important thing to know is that mind consciousness is dependently arisen. It rises dependent on a mind and its objects. In order to have a mind consciousness, you have to have a mind and its objects, and its object. And the function of mind consciousness turns out to be the source of this representation only, Because mind consciousness, its function is that it conceptualizes and it thinks about and it conceptualizes and it makes an image of the interaction between mind and consciousness. So this is the heart of the mind-only understanding that I was reading and discussing earlier, is that based on the function of manovijnana, of mind consciousness, an image of the interaction between subject and object forms in the mind, and what we know, and the position of the Yogacara is that what we generally know is only that conceptualization or that image. So when a bodhisattva is wise in respect to that kind of situation, where he or she is aware that what is arising in the mind is a conceptualization, then a wise bodhisattva does a meditation aimed at looking at the process of conceptualization. A wise bodhisattva is interested in the images that are coming up in relation to sense experience. So, you know, this is why this is the kind of meditation we do in Zazen, right? We look at what is arising in the mind. If we're wise, according to the sutra. So, and it could be, for instance, when you have a blue jay singing outside your window, what arises in the mind is that blue jay shouldn't be there. That's what's arising in your mind. So we look at that, right? We look at it shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be like this. I hate that. I love this. We look at those. Okay, we're conceptualizing about our experience. Fine, look at that. It might not be as beautiful as letting the blue jay come into your heart, but if we compare our practice to somebody who, you know, talks like that, then we would be making another conceptualization that we should then study. So mind consciousness is at the common sense center of Zazen practice, right? Looking at what comes up in consciousness, and understanding it's a reflection of what's really happening, but really paying attention to the reflection. Don't discount the reflection. Very important. See what's happening in mind consciousness. Don't sit there and say, well, it's only a reflection, it doesn't count. That's not the point. The point is, it is arising in consciousness. So pay attention to it. Pay attention to what is arising in consciousness. And understanding that it's a reflection or that it's an image or that it's an imagination, I think that is actually helpful, or at least considering that it's temporary, fleeting, insubstantial. These things, of course, this is what we do in our practice. So I put a quote in the handout from a case that several years Reb Anderson was quoting and talking about for, it seemed like, quite a long time, and it's a case in the Book of Serenity called Gweishan's Active Consciousness. Active consciousness is manovijnana. It is this consciousness of this is the sixth sense, sixth consciousness. It's just ordinary mind consciousness that arises based on objects. And in the commentary to the case, he says, Haven't you heard it said, if you turn back the light in an instant of thought, it's the same as original realization? So this is just like Dogen, right? This is just Dogen saying, turn back the light to realize the self, to illuminate the self. So, the teaching about mind consciousness is that it's always going on, and there's only like a few rare cases where it isn't active. One is a coma, and the other is a deep dreamless sleep, and then there's a third actually, which is a certain kind of yogic meditation that turns off mind consciousness. And I think the women's study group was just recently studying a case about a practitioner who had the capacity to go into that yogic trance of turning off mind consciousness so that, nothing was happening. But for the most part, throughout most of our waking lives and much of our sleeping lives, mind consciousness is still active. And, you can have the sense of through dreams, and just especially when I go on retreat, I really realize that during my sleep, my mind was just continuing its activity. Whether I was dreaming or not, I could feel that my mind really never stopped. But maybe it did sometimes, but I could see that it didn't stop, a lot of the time. So mind consciousness is active consciousness. And so that's the good for us, though, because for meditators, we need an object for our meditation. So, to have something active popping up all the time gives us lots to work with. So it's not a bad thing. Now I'm going to skip. Doing pretty well. I'm going to skip from the sixth consciousness to this new invention that appears in the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra, and then is taken up with great enthusiasm by the Yogacara school. Transformation of mind called the Alaya Vijnana. It is what is referred to as mind in the question, how is a bodhisattva wise with respect to mind, thought, and consciousness? So the Alaya Vijnana is also called the storehouse consciousness. Some people have heard of that, maybe? The storehouse consciousness. And it's the sense of it is it's like a place where if you put yourself back in the 3rd century, you would have had, you still have those now, places where grain is stored, a granary, where grain or seeds are stored. So that's the image of a place where grain or seeds are stored. And what is stored in the storehouse consciousness are called seeds. Actually, that's the word, the technical word that the Yogacarans used, seeds. And what those seeds are is the result of karma. So the results of karma is what is stored in the storehouse consciousness. And from that place, without any conscious intervention on our part, those seeds have the ability to ripen and come to fruition and influence our thinking and our reactions to things in our daily lives. And the actions that we do in daily life is like putting more more replacement seeds in the granary. So the Alaya Vijnana has a lot in common with the modern conception of a subconscious, of a place we can't see, a mind that we can't see, but we can often see its the fruiting of the seeds or the rising of karma from that storehouse, from that subconscious place. And this is things like somebody says something in a certain way and we're in a certain mood, and all of a sudden we are just angry. We just find anger just boom, it just ripens just like that. And where did that come from? You know, you often have that sense, don't you? If you get angry, or that where did that come from? You know, we don't see where it comes from, and yet it's suddenly it's changed our whole physiology. It's changed it's caused our speech to get louder. It's lots of things that are happening. I used to notice when I got angry. I haven't had this in a while, but I used to notice when I got angry, my lip would curl, and it was totally involuntary. It was like my lip would do something. It would. I can't even make it do it. You know, it was like coming from the subconscious, and it was coming from, I don't know. You know, the physiologist would tell us it's coming from the limbic system or something like that. But this is the idea that the Yogacharans had back in the 5th century or earlier, that there was this storehouse where experience was stored and could ripen. And I think, most of us have had, some contact with subconscious experience or non-rational experiences that we that happen to us or that we participate in, or that seem to happen, and where we can't find any conscious thought, any intellectual thought that we made that experience happen, that we made that thing happen, that we thought something and then it happened. To think something and then it happened is more like mano vijnana. To have this come from the alaya vijnana is like it just comes, and it comes from this place that we can't see. Yeah, question.
So it's not a memory.
No, it's not a memory.
Not like that.
In the sense that karma is a kind of memory, but it's not a conscious memory. So I was going to give you an example of something that happened to me while I was studying the Samandhi Nirmochana Sutra. I spent a whole afternoon and evening reading this. You know, it's difficult. It's very difficult. And text. It uses lots of language that is very, we're just not really familiar with, and you don't. So anyway, I'm going back and forth between the translator's notes and the text, and I'm spending like an afternoon and evening just going back and forth, trying to get my arms around what's what the meaning is. We're trying to understand this chapter, and I spent an afternoon, and then I either took a nap or it was when I went to sleep. I don't remember what, but I had this image arise in my mind of an empty sack, and no matter how much stuff I put in the sack, it never got any weight in it. It never got any more stuff in it. And somehow, this image was quite encouraging. I felt really encouraged by this image, and all of this happened in an instant. I mean, it was this fleeting impression that just went through me And I didn't will it in any sense. I didn't will this experience in any sense. So this, we can often, almost everybody probably has this experience just as you're going to sleep and you have this twilight experiences. And has anybody not had that kind of experience where you're just falling asleep and and some really weird thought or irrational image or something, you know, quite out of...
None of us ever had that. It's just you.
Oh, yeah. So that's. I think you've had that experience. So that is... you know, that's this idea of things just, you know, coming out of the storehouse consciousness. And, you know, sharing this territory with what we would call today the subconscious. So the, and the Yogacarans, I mean, Reb in his book says, well, the Yogacarans created or invented the Alaya Vijnana in order to account for what happened to the life force. How did the life force continue when they went into yogic states that where all thought ceased? How did the life force continue? So in that story that you're reading in the women's study group, there's a person meditating and they can't be nobody can, even the advanced bodhisattvas cannot bring them out of the trance. They're in this state of complete cessation. And then another bodhisattva called Delusive Wisdom, go figure, comes along and is able to bring this person out of that trance. So the Yogacarans were, they kind of had to, you know, the you can't really see the Alaya, you can't really see directly the subconscious, but you see its results, and so we invent these terms to take account. You know, one of the valid sources of knowledge in Buddhism is inference. Okay, it doesn't have to be direct experience. We can infer things, and because of the way that our subconscious behaves, we have to infer that it if we want to have a complete understanding of consciousness. In other words, we want to have a comprehensive understanding of consciousness. We have to infer that there is something called the subconscious or the Alaya Vijnana. So. When I was on retreat in January, Reb was talking about Reb Anderson, whose book I also read in preparation for this class, or have read parts of it. This is a book that I couldn't read for many years. It seemed almost impossible to read, and then I persisted finally for the purposes of this class, and now. Amazingly enough, find it quite brilliant. But it's one of those books where you read three pages and you go, no, I can't read this.
Time for a nap.
Time for a nap. But
what book?
It's called The Third Turning of the Wheel. Yeah, and it's chapter by chapter on the on this sutra. But anyway, he brought up this. This quote in my retreat, and he also brings it up in the book. And his quote is from D.H. Lawrence, and he said, and this is what D.H. Lawrence says: "This is what I know. The world of my conscious self is like a little clearing in a dark forest. Deities come out of the forest now and then they go back. This is what I know. The world of my conscious self is like a little clearing in a dark forest. Deities come out of the forest now and then they go back." So the dark forest is analogous to the Alaya Vijnana. It's dark, it's dense, and we can't really see what's going on in there. But both demons and deities are hidden there, and they more or less are continually coming out to visit. And I, when I came back from my retreat, I didn't characterize it in this way, but I told you how how much it was like that. How much it was like that, that, you know, your stuff is coming up, and you're sitting more and more, all your unconscious stuff, and it's not pretty. A lot of it is not pretty. But that's part of the process of, because one of the things that we think is possible is that we can transform the Alaya. We can let the demons and the deities come, and we can let them come and come and come. And the more they come, the less darkness there is in the forest, and the bigger the clearing is, the more we let the demons and the deities come. And if we don't let the deities come, then we're not, you know, we cut ourselves off from creativity, from intuitive knowing. We cut ourselves off from the positive information that can come from the subconscious. When we do the drawing thing, I think we'll probably be taught, you know, let go of thinking. Let something come. You know, let something come. Similarly, if we don't acknowledge the demons in the Alaya, if we don't acknowledge the negative karma that's stored there, if we deny it, or we're not willing to look at it, or we're unconscious, it's just coming and it's having its results. Its results are manifesting, but we're not acknowledging it as, we're not curious about it. We're not saying, where is this coming from? What is this about? But instead, we're just sort of, being pummeled by the stuff that's coming up, by the demonic forces that are within us. Then, in that case, we can cause harm. We can cause harm to ourselves. We can cause harm to others if we aren't in touch with the demonic side or the negative karma that's stored and that is influencing our lives. So it's a very nice, this dark forest is a very nice image to play with, and it really worked for me. It really kind of grabbed me when I heard it at the retreat, and then when I, it's in that book that I never wanted to read. So then the question arises. And I'm getting toward the end, so we'll be able to have some questions. The question arises, if this transformative path is available. In other words, if we can be in a transformative relationship with the Alaya by allowing, its productions to touch us, and we get into some positive dialogue with them, we have this possibility of transforming the Alaya, bringing everything out of the dark forest. And actually, they say if you completely transform the Alaya, then you essentially merge with Buddha's wisdom. So, but we see, of course, that many people aren't doing that. And so how do we account for, or why isn't everybody on this transformative path? How is it that many people seem to have a very small clearing, and they seem to be surrounded by a big dark forest, and we see that it's really, they seem to be kind of enclosed. You know, people are enclosed. People are surrounded, and you see people that are surrounded. And of course, when you're surrounded by the dark forest, you know, bad things can happen if you don't make some space there, some space in the light. So the explanation is for that in the sutra is manas. Manas is the literal translation is simply mind, but and here in the sutra it's translated as thought, but in the Buddhist dictionary there's a better translation, a more impactful translation, and that is afflicted mentality. So klishta manas, that's the number six, that's number seven. That's number seven in the eight consciousnesses that we're talking about, five sense consciousnesses, one mind consciousness, one manas, and then alaya vijnana, number eight. So number seven, manas, afflicted consciousness, and the understanding there is afflicted consciousness takes the alaya as its object, and it thinks it assumes that the productions of the alaya are real and substantial, and it takes and it looks at those productions and it says that's a self. It looks at what's coming up in the alaya, what's rising, demonic and deities that are arising are myself. That is myself. So it looks at the that's what an afflicted mentality do. That's what an afflicted mentality does. And it identifies the ripening seeds of the alaya as I, me, and mine. So it identifies ripening karma as I, me, and mine. So manas is the Yogacara's answer to those that say, I exist. I am here having these experiences. The Yogacara wants to account for everything. Everybody here will not be able to deny that they have a sense that they are. Everybody, pretty much, has an idea that they are. And so the Yogacara wants to account for that. I think they just want to have a complete picture of this, what consciousness is. And so they posit the manas, and they say, well, it's because it's looking into the alaya and it's taking that karmic production and it's labeling it as a self. So, and then, you know, Vasubandhu, he says that klishta manas always arises accompanied by self-pride, self-love, self-confusion, and self-view. Klishta manas is self-consciousness. It's a clouded mirror that prevents us from having a clear view of how things really are. Klishta manas is translated as thought, which of course links it to a meditation tradition that acknowledges thought as a barrier and recommends going beyond thinking. To go beyond thinking is to clearly see things as they are, free of the taints of self.
Are you reading from the book, Jim?
No, I read that. I wrote that. So I'm going to end with the final verse of the this chapter. We've only been talking about one chapter in the 10 chapter Samdhi Nirmocana Sutra, but this kind of summarizes in a way. And the final verse is, if the storehouse consciousness, deep and subtle, all its seeds flowing like a river, were conceived of as a self, That would not be right. Thus, I have not taught this to the unwise. If the storehouse consciousness, deep and subtle, all its seeds flowing like a river, were conceived as a self, that would not be right. Thus, I have not taught this to the unwise. So, I will end there. And, yeah, Barry.
So, in Yogacara, there's eight consciousness, is that correct?
Right, Yogacara, yeah.
Sorry. I was thinking, like, so, in, like, classic Buddhism, you know, there's the eight dhanas.
The eight?
Dhanas. Am I pronouncing it wrong? Dhanas. Jhanas.
Jhanas?
Jhanas.
Oh,
sorry.
Jhanas.
Jhanas.
Oh, okay, Jhanas. Yeah.
I think that might be a word I've only read and never said, but... You know, and so, I mean, the basic idea, you know, these are ascending levels of consciousness, and, you know, and then they kind of, you know, it's like right concentration, then you can get the Buddhahood. It almost seems like this is like a reverse of that, where, like, you're kind of getting farther and farther away Buddhahood as you go up the ladder, you know, of the different consciousness. And I wonder if there's, anyone's ever correlated the Jhanas, is that right?
Jhanas.
With the, you know, kind of the reverse storehouse consciousness. That just kind of popped in my mind for some reason.
Hmm. Well, I've never made such a correlation. I don't know. I don't see a natural linkage there. I mean, Buddhism, of course, has many lists. And I don't think we should necessarily take the eight as something that we would... then, you know, tie to that myself. I mean, those are meditative attainments, if you will. So they describe kind of a yogic path, you know, in our practice. But you know, I don't exactly see. The same. I don't see the connection exactly. Yeah.
Well, taking on that note, at least a little bit on that. So we're studying.
You got to hold the thing.
We're studying Yogacara here as the kind of the evolution of Zen, in a sense of where it originated in India and then moves to China and then Japan and so on as this.
Can I interrupt? Kind of as on a formative influence on Zen.
Right,
yeah.
And it gets culturized along the way to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so, when you say that Alajja Vijnana was quote unquote invented by the Yogacarans to express. I guess consciousness in that way, the mind that way. How does that depart then from the other traditions or the other schools? I mean, how did this begin to start to evolve, so to speak, into ultimately Zen? And this is the precursor of that, as you're saying. How did they split off like that? I mean, how did the other schools view this differently? And was this the great divide? Or
mm-hmm. Well, I want to take back the idea, the word invent, which I believe I did use. But the Sandhi Nirmachana is the word of the Buddha, according to our tradition. And the Sandhi Nirmachana Sutra posits or teaches the storehouse consciousness. So we, you know, take it as the word of the Buddha. So the Yogacarans focused on it. They elaborated it, but, you know, the understanding is that it is the word of the Buddha. As far as its influence on Zen, it is, I think, the most strong indication that what the subject, what Zen represents, that what we need to do in our meditation is study the self. And one way of talking about that is to study the mind. I think in the last class I said, that Zen is a tradition pointing directly at the human mind, directly at the human mind. And so this is what Yogacara says we really need to do, because the mind is the source of the representations about the world. The world is not actually the source that we need to study for Zen. You don't need to study the outer world. What you need to study is the way that world is appearing, the representations of that world in the mind. The mind needs to learn to turn back and study the mind. And so that is the key. That is like the heart of Zen in a way. And so Yogacara is really pointing at pointing us to, turn the light back, turn the light of consciousness around, and study. There's this great line. I was going to bring it up next week, but I'll bring it up now because it's a great line from the seventh chapter of the eighth chapter of the Samdhi Nirmachana Sutra, which is study the mind that is, study the uninterrupted mind. Study the mind that is uninterrupted, something like that. It's more eloquently stated. But anyway, it's the real influence of the Yogacara is to have us essentially turn inward to study what's arising in the mind as the most important thing to pay attention to. I'm not sure that we can actually, according to the Buddhism, actually we can have a direct experience. That is possible for us to have a direct, unmediated experience. The Yogacara says most of our experience is mediated by consciousness. It's consciousness, and consciousness only is what we see. But the Yogacarans are only saying that in order to get us to wake up, to get us to pay attention to the mediation that consciousness is doing. So they look, this is how it's equivalent to the Buddha saying, originally, look, everything is, there's suffering. There's suffering. Pay attention. So I believe that this is the Yogacarans telling us, pay attention to the way mind is interpreting, mediating, representing reality, and study that.
Study the mind that has a non-conceptual image.
The quote?
Yeah.
No, it's better than that. But we'll get it. I'll get it. I'll bring it next week. It's like that, but it's just differently put. And I'll bring it next week. Yeah, Doralee.
So this quote that you have under the manas,
mm-hmm.
It says manas serve the function of a distorting mirror of the impressions and seeds of the alaya.
Mm-hmm.
So that the seeds of the alaya themselves.
Interesting.
Are seeds of enlightenment.
Well,
the manas, these activities of the consciousness actually take those seeds and distort them.
Yes, Yes. And the distortion is that manas is simply the function of consciousness that looks at the seeds and attributes selfness to them.
Okay.
You know.
Thank you.
Oh, real life example.
A real life example.
Okay. A certain physiological reaction happens in me when somebody comes up and slaps me across the face. Okay? Remember about my lip curling? There's heat, and then there's these different physical things happening. The function of manas is say, I am angry. I am going to punch this person back. I'm going to do something. I'm having some experience.
I don't deserve to be treated this way or whatever.
Right, right. So it's the application of the sense of I to any experience, essentially.
Thank you.
Matthew.
I was just wondering, when I read about storehouse consciousness before, I saw it as a collective unconsciousness, that, you know, when we create karma, we put it in and then we all pull from it. Is it like that, or is it more like a subconscious?
Well, I asked my teacher the very same question, and he said there is a shared part of it, but that he did not buy the collective part of it. I don't know that I fully understand this, but his answer was not collective unconscious, more like subconscious, more like unseen forces within that are the results of karma. Yeah, not Jungian, more Freudian, perhaps. Larry.
Somewheres I remember reading Thich Nhat Hanh discussing stored consciousness, and he mentioned that, and I think if I remember correctly, do the Buddhists classify all thought, speech, and conduct as either positive, neutral, or negative? And if I'm correct there, I think what Thich Nhat Hanh was saying about stored consciousness is that by taking positive thought, speech, or conduct, you can ripen the positive seeds that are dormant in stored consciousness, and if you water them.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, did the Yogacharans discuss this from your studies at all, or is this something that came afterwards?
I think John has an answer.
I just remember taking a class of Reb, which he talked at length about perfuming.
He used the word perfuming, and it's kind of like, I also understand, and please correct me, is that it's not just the extreme mental states that are caused, that arise from the seeds of the storehouse consciousness. I think everything that appears in the conscious mind emerges from the storehouse consciousness.
Deities and demons.
Yeah, and it just little stuff. That's kind of things you think. And also I was thinking that it's a good explanation for habit energy and just how you carve like a deep rut, which gets to the part about if you habitually respond to the things that arise in the same way, you're just carving a deeper habit and rut. You're creating more seeds, like you said. But then, as to what you said, it was like if you get enough distance from your identification of self or whatever, that you could start treating these things that arise in a kind of beneficial way, then you're kind of perfuming them and watering the seeds of better things to arise. I don't know.
Well, or a non-reactive way.
The non-reactivity would also would be part of like that would be part of the continuing building process of kind of like opening up the storehouse to the emergence of more positive things.
Yeah, and practicing, you know, six paramitas and
right,
you know, 10 precepts and other, you know, 3 pure precepts. Doing those kind of practices lays, you know, influences future karma, you know.
Did the Yogacharans discuss that?
Did the Yogacharans discuss that?
Yeah, the perfuming, the watering.
I think they did. I can't quote you, but I think they did discuss that there were the later in Vasubandhu, we'll see if when we get to that, you know, he talks about the various factors of mind that are based on the ripening of seeds, and there's quite a list, and so we'll see that maybe in the fall or maybe sometime in the summer when we start looking at Ben Connolly's book. There were some hands back there. Raphael, you want to say something?
Well, I was in the clearing, but the dark forest came back.
Uh-huh.
I'm in the dark forest.
Thank you, Raphael. So two thoughts arose for me during the talk, for which thank you. One was the thought that if the Yogacharans, the pre-Yogacharans, and postulated the Alaya to include in the Vijnana model in order to account for the fact that people could go into deep states of where there was no conscious movement and survive. So there must have been something, a life force that continues, and let's call it the Alaya storehouse. Then getting into contact with that is coming into contact with the source of life in that model. And that's much like the Jungian and maybe Freudian model of the unconscious being where the life force resides. The other thought is when is Buddhism verse regarding the observation of the river of the seeds should not be interpreted as a self. What rose for me was the image which Myo Lehi shared with us a couple of weeks ago about a twirling torch, a torch being twirled at the end of an arm, appearing to be a circle. Actually, it's not a circle. It's a point of light moving rapidly. But it moves so fast that per our perceptual capabilities, it appears to be a torch.
Right.
So it seems like the river of seeds, it seems to me the river source of seeds is a similar metaphor. If you stop and look at one seed, it's one emerging seed from the Alaya, one ripening seed. But because they come as a river, not just in extraordinary moments of anger or such like, but as John says, continually.
Yeah. That's the image.
They appear to be a river. So there's and it's that riverness, that continuity of it, that gives rise, I believe, to the sense of self.
Well, it's according to the understanding is it's this consciousness called manas, looking at the river, looking into the river. That's the understanding. It looks at the river and it says that's itself. You know, that's what this function of consciousness does.
If one were to, through some unusual experience, notice that the river was actually was not a river, that the torch was not a circle, but was actually a point of light or one seed in a flow, would that still be the manas of making that observation?
I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Brittany, you want to?
Do you have time?
Yeah. Well, not really, but okay. People can leave if they want.
So hopefully really quick. I hear instructions and read lots of different instructions about demons coming out in the dark, right? And in some traditions, you in a meditative state, you would sit and you would just perceive these negative feelings, right? And you would sit with them and they say, don't judge them and don't think too much on them, just to feel them and be present with them. But it seems like the Yogacharan point of view is to actually try and see where they're coming from?
I would say no. It's just like that, just like the first thing you said. Okay. Just the fact that you acknowledge that there are demons coming. Mm-hmm. And you don't actually try to prevent them from coming. No. Let them come bear the slings and arrows of demons coming. And sometimes it's very difficult to sit still when certain things are coming. It's very hard. And maybe sometimes you can't sit still, and that's okay too. You know, we can't always sit still depending on what's coming. So we sit still with what we can, and what we can't, we find some other way, or we just, you know, respond our habitual way because that's what we sort of, that's all that we've got, you know. So, you know, the teaching is to just let it all come, and there's some amazing stories of the Buddha letting all kinds of stuff come. Like tigers come and eating his body, and he just willingly gives his body to the tiger and that sort of thing. But, you know, we're not all Buddha. So we practice where we are, letting what we can absorb, and what we can't, we ask for some help. I think that's the main thing. Ask for some help. Yeah. Where we can't, you know, deal with what's coming. I know Bob had his hand up, but it's getting late. You pass? Okay.
Don't make any of this into things.
Right. It's a class.
You don't want tigers eating you? Actual tigers?
We lost our Eno and everything, so may our intention...